Hello, 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 and welcome back to the IBS Freedom Podcast. Did you miss us? Of course you did. We are ready and raring to get season two on your metaphorical plate. So without further ado, I'm Nikki. I never introduced myself in season one. So that's like a resolution that I'm going to say my name and introduce myself more often in season two. And I am, of course, joined by my lovely co-host, Amy Hollenkamp. And honestly, Amy has more exciting life updates. So this is just going to be like a fun one. We'll tell you what we've been up to these last couple of months. But Amy, take it away, because you have some pretty noteworthy updates for the people at home, right?
Yeah. And I would say, first off, I feel bad that I didn't introduce you. I think I just get so spazzy about the intros. I don't know why. I'm just like, you're so much better at doing them than me.
I probably make it unnecessarily difficult to like interject and introduce me. So it's like largely on me. I don't really...
I don't know. I feel like I should have done a better job as a co-host to be like, and you here's know. My bud, Nikki. But
well,
yeah,
we have a whole nother season to improve for the people. So that'll be one resolution. Really quick before we get into your adorable updates, you might notice new and improved audio for this episode, people. Not because we got new microphones, but because we recently learned how to use the microphones correctly. And that apparently makes a difference. So if you notice that our voices sound super sexy right now, it's because we're using the microphones correctly for the first time literally ever. So applause for us for that. Also, just full disclaimer. Episodes. I know. We only did 100 episodes with the mics incorrectly, arranged. So it's all right. It's all right. But also, I wanted to throw in before we get into actual updates, I'm just recovering from COVID. And if you hear me clearing my throat a little bit more than normal, that's probably why. And I'm desperately trying to resist the urge to cough, because then it'll be a nightmare in post-production if I have to go back and beat the tracks. So apologies, but we're here now. And now, without further ado, Amy, tell the people. Tell the people.
Yeah. So I'm lighter these days because I have had a baby. So I've been on maternity leave. I think everyone that's kind of been a listener knows that. But yeah, so now I have a little baby girl named Cecilia. She's a little angel.
She has more hair than you.
She has way more hair than me. I would say, like, I've never realized how much baby hair is such a crowd pleaser, but my God, wherever we go, it's like people freak out with her hair. Some people want to take pictures of her because of her hair. And I'm just like, oh my Lord.
She literally has a full adult head of hair.
Right. She looks like it looks like a toupee. It really does. But it's so funny too, because like when I was having her, that was what the doctors were seeing. They were like, oh my gosh, she has so much hair. Like, hair was just spilling out down there when I was pushing her out.
And did you say one of the doctors was like twiddling the hair as she was coming
out? Yes. Yes. My mom was laughing because, she said it was like kind of sweet. Like that it was like a very sweet, like action. Like, she wasn't making a big deal of it, but like my mom was just watching her. She was just like twirling her hair down there as it was coming out. Like, that's how much hair she had. Like, it was just spilling out. It was all over the place. But it was funny too, because I kept pushing and being like, okay, when the hell is this baby coming out? Like, I'm pushing hard. Like, is the head out? And they're all like, no, just more hair. Like, we had a couple more strands of hair. And I'm like, oh Christ. So, but yeah, it was very, childbirth is an interesting, I could do a whole podcast on my birth experience too, but yeah, it's
the word I would use is terrible, but I know that that's not always the case, but just for me personally, it was awful.
Well, I think again, like, it was so interesting because, and I think you went into it too, like, I sort of went into it like, I want to use as little intervention as possible.
Yeah.
Which, again, like, I'm watching all these birth stories, too. And the good news is I did watch, like, birth stories that were different. So it wasn't just, like, natural births, or, like, some were C-section births, some were epidural births, some were kind of, like, a mix of like, oh, they got like half an epidural. So I like watched a ton of different births, which was kind of fascinating. But like some births, you know, you'll watch and it's like they're in labor for like 6 hours and the baby's out and you're like, oh, that'd be perfect. Like, no wonder they're my talking about their like yeah, it's like no wonder they're talking about their amazing childbirth experience. Yeah. Their baby was out in like 6 hours.
I think my mother-in-law was in labor with my husband for like 2 hours and then just pop, out he came.
Right. What? It's insane. It's insane. Yeah. I think, again, like second babies too are, and third babies, like, are you like basically sneeze them out sort of. So like, I think that it's a bit different for those, but like for me, again, like I went in thinking, okay, if I could have her natural, that'd be amazing, but I'm not against an epidural. Like I was kind of open to all interventions, but like, let's try to do it the least intervention as possible. And I did the hypnobirthing stuff, which helped, which I do think helped during labor, like keep me calm and like, but I just was in labor for so long. I had basically been standing for like 18 hours because I couldn't sit, like sitting, the contractions were way worse when I was sitting. So I was just like standing for, and I was stuck in this triage room for 8 hours because there was no, they couldn't admit me because there were no rooms, which was terrible. So I was basically standing for like 18 hours and my legs, like I couldn't stand any longer. And I was like, well, I can't lay down and endure these when I'm sitting. So I was like, I need the epidural. Mm. And it's like the second the epidural hit, I was like, ah. And then I ate a whole bunch of popsicles. And then everything was fine. Everything was fine really once I got admitted. The labor wasn't too bad. It kind of progressed really quickly once they gave me like Pitocin and stuff to speed. Her heartbeat was really weird too, which kind of made them want to accelerate things a bit. Mm. The cord was wrapped around her neck. And I think that that's maybe what was causing some of the heartbeat stuff. But
I wonder how common that is as a side note, because it's really common. That was the case for Jess and it was the case for me.
Right.
Like, and I've heard that from other moms too. So it seems like that's actually fairly common.
I think it's really common, actually. I actually don't think it causes as much problems. Like in my pre-labor material, like when I was doing some research for my labor, they kind of made it seem like it was way more common than you'd think. And it doesn't always mean like you need like an emergency C-section or something, you know, to get the baby out. But it was funny because I remember when we were at one of our gyno appointments, there was a doctor in the hallway and they were like, oh, I had the craziest delivery. The baby's head or the cord was wrapped around the baby 8 times. And like, that's really, that was like the most she had ever seen. Dang. So she was talking about it in the hallway and I was like, oh my God, I hope Cece's not like that. You know, like,
also, how long was that cord?
Yeah, I know. Well, it was funny too. I had a really, really long cord. Like they were talking about how long my cord was. I don't know if that's like a good thing or a bad thing, but I just have a long, luxurious cord. You're breaking
records at that hospital left and right. You're breaking records for longest cord, hairiest child.
Right, exactly. Well, and I think too, like probably the nurses can make or break your experience too, I'd imagine, in labors. I had like the best nurses. Like the first one was really sweet and she was pregnant. She was like 33 weeks pregnant, like maneuvering my dead epidural legs around on this peanut ball. Like the poor thing was just like having trouble. And then I was so sad because she was leaving at 7, like in the evening, and I was really progressing. So like the baby was coming out that night. So I was like, oh man, like she's just missing the birth. But then we got this other nurse who was amazing too. And she was just like, I can't believe how strong she was, because she was like holding my one leg. And then Armand and my mom were like taking turns holding my other leg because they both like couldn't deal with holding it the whole time. But like my nurse was just holding it the whole time. Like, right. It's like, oh my God, it's crazy. But I think that's the other thing that kind of surprised me about the birth. It's like you kind of expect there to be more people in the room when you're like pushing. But when I was pushing, it was literally like just my mom, my husband, and then this nurse for like 90% of the time. The doctor was there at the beginning and would kind of come and check in and see how I was progressing. And then kind of at the very end, she was there. So maybe it was more like 80% of the time that she was that it was just the nurse and my mom and my husband. But yeah, like the nurse or the actual doctor wasn't really in the room much. Like they just kind of come to catch the baby.
Yeah, they get all the cred.
Right. So yeah, it was such an interesting, wild ride. And my husband, who like was really nervous about the birth because he's kind of squeamish, he got into it, although he did throw up once. Did I tell you this? He threw up.
I feel like maybe I want you to tell the story of when Armand did he throw up or pass out recently with the straw?
Oh my gosh. Okay. Well, first, there's a couple funny stories with Armand. So Armand was also like joking a bunch during the birth, and the doctors and nurses like didn't know like how to read him, I feel like. Which, like, we were pretty relaxed, honestly, during the labor compared, I think, to some. But he kept being like, well, I have a movie to go to. Like, just making stupid jokes, like, during the labor and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Which I think some women would, like, hate. But, like, for me, it was just, like, oh, kind of comforting that he was just, you know, being himself. But he, at one point, like, I see him on the side of the bed. And then all of a sudden he like disappears like from the side of the bed. And I'm like, oh, he's going to sit down on the chair. And then all of a sudden he's back. And then after I had CC, the nurse was like, hey, like I saw you like throw up in your mouth back there and swallow it. Like, so I guess he just like freaked out for a minute and was like, okay, I got to get back in there. So he like left the scene for a minute and then came back after he had done his business. But he was just... He was ridiculous too. He like went, the doctor was like, I had a second degree tear, and the doctor was like stitching me up, and he's like, oh my gosh, you look totally normal down there. Like, and the doctor's just cracking up. Like, it was just like the most ridiculous conversation.
Like, who says this other than our
right? And then like, it cracks me up because like, so I have her and she nurses super well, like right out the gate, like probably the longest nursing session I've had with her. Cause usually she's like a super fast eater. Like our pediatrician says, oh, she's a piranha baby. Cause first off, my boobs just like release so much milk right away. And then she just feeds for like 5 minutes on each side and then she's done. And she fed for 15 minutes on each side. And so she was like a really good feeder, which was like kind of a relief. Mm-hmm. And then, Armand was going to like hold her after I did my skin to skin. So he was doing skin to skin. And then he was freaking out because she was like going for his nipple, you know? And he was like, Amy, get the nurse. I'm like, Armand, I just had a baby. Like, I can't get the nurse. Like, if you want, and you're not going to get the nurse because she's like going after your nipple. Like, he was on another just level.
Move her. She can barely move to begin with at this stage.
He was just like pick
her up and move her to a slightly different area of your chest.
Well, and that's the problem. He was so like stiff, you know, like he just like hadn't held tons of babies. So it's like he like didn't know what to do. Like he like couldn't.
He was an awkward turtle.
Super awkward turtle. It's so funny how fast that changes too. Like,
yeah,
you can't really be an awkward turtle for very long.
You figure it out pretty quick. I feel like then, like after it's been a while since you've had a baby, then you kind of become a little bit of an awkward turtle again. Because we had my cousin visit a couple of weeks ago with their 10-month-old. And like my husband, you could tell, like did not compute. He didn't know how to be around a baby anymore. It was really funny. I feel like I still mostly did. And like I was holding him and stuff. But yeah, Mike was like, what is this thing?
Right. Yeah, it's weird. Again, like, I think if you're not around babies for a while, it can be weird. And he, like, hasn't really had a close relationship with a baby. Like, I feel like my sister was 6 years younger than me growing up. So, like, I remember vividly, like, her being my baby. And, like, my parents didn't care because she was the fourth. So, like, I was, like, six. I was, like, Jess's age, like, with the baby under my arm, like...
Yeah.
You know, flinging her around our house. My parents were like, oh, Amy's got her, you know, she's fine. I was like six. So it is funny. Like, so like I had her and then my two nieces and my nephew. So like I've just been around a lot of babies. And Armand's kind of been around somewhat with my nephew. But it, again, just like nothing super intense or close. So
yeah,
he was funny right out the gate. But yeah, I think again, like, so we got through the birth and
please, for the love of God, tell the straw story.
Okay. So, well, first let me just say that I don't think most people know this. I keep bringing it up and people are like, you know, not like, I don't know if they're surprised or what. I don't know. But babies cannot coordinate. Yeah, babies cannot. Our pediatrician told us, which our pediatrician has been amazing. Like, shout out to Dr. Landorf. But our pediatrician was saying that, like, babies, the reason they get so fussy when they're gassy is they can't coordinate their butthole to release the gas. So they can feel all this gas build up. And so they're pushing, 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 but then it's stuck. Like, everything's just, it's a closed door down there. And they can't release, like, they can't release the gas or the poop or whatever. They're like push, push, pushing. Mm-hmm. And again, like, the sad thing is with little babies, like, they push so hard and it, like, the more they tense and push, the more they're, like, closed because they're not relaxed. Mm-hmm. That's why, like, sometimes, which Cece was never this, but my mom said, like, a lot of us were where we would, like, go in the bathtub and, like, relax and just, like, poop everywhere. Like, mm-hmm. a lot of babies are kind of like that too. But again, you almost, like, have to get them relaxed before they can poop or whatever. But anyway, so our pediatrician was saying, oh, you have to get, like, this butt straw. And I'm like, what? And she was like, yeah, it's a butt straw. And she, like, pulled it up for me on her computer. It was like, it's this. Like, you just have to buy this. And I don't think it's called a butt straw. That's
but
kind
if you
of
Google
her.
It, you'll probably find it. And maybe
right,
some
if
other
you Google
weird
butt
websites.
Straw for baby. It's called, like a something whistle or something. Windy. It's called Wendy's. Wendy's something. Okay. It's by Frida, the brand, but, like, it's basically this little, like, it has, like, a straw-type tip, but it has a stopper so you don't go too far. But, like, you kind of just stick it into their butt, and literally it makes, like, a whistling sound. It's, like as their gas comes out, and, like, you can see their little bodies, like instantly relax. But they're also, like, they say to have a diaper ready because poop comes out, too, like, out of the straw. And the first time we used it, my husband threw up. He did not do well with the poop coming out of the straw. That freaked
Poor
him
Armand.
Out. But yeah, it's again, I did read that you don't want to, like, overuse it. So I've kind of only used it, like, if she's really backed up and uncomfortable, I'll kind of use it. Especially if we're, like, going somewhere and I'm like, well, she's going to be really pissed off at this place, or we could kind of, like, help her out a little bit. I think we've only used it 3 or 4 times, but, like, they kind of advise you not to overuse it because then they don't learn how to open up their butt on their own. So, but then I went to the pediatrician recently and she said that they can usually learn how to coordinate their little butthole by the time they're 3 weeks or 13 weeks old. So she's, like, right there. She's really close. It's already getting easier. So I think she's, like, already kind of developing the skill. But
now here's the question. So when Cece gets to be 13 weeks old, are you going to throw her a hooray, you can control your sphincters party? Because
I should.
We've got to see this on Instagram. You've got to take photos and, like, dorky party hats. Chip's got to be involved.
Oh my God. I love it. Yeah. I need to, like, get her some poop outfits. I think she has one. I forget what it says on it, but there is a poop emoji on it. I just pulled it out of our, Armand's very organized with her clothes. So, like, we have all our clothes, like, for different ages, but she's getting, like, her 0 to 3 month is too tight now. So, like, she's easing. We've just swapped out a bunch of onesies for, like, the 3 to 6 months, which they're a little big, but they're actually not terrible on her. But yeah, I need to get her, like, some poop outfits to wear and for Instagram.
Stool themed.
Right. Well, and I have been getting a lot of Instagram ad messages for, I think it's called, like, Tiny Health or something. Mm-hmm. There is a stool test company for babies now. I don't know if you've heard of this.
I haven't heard of that brand, but I know you were telling me, either a text message or a Marco Polo or something, you were telling me that you were getting these ads.
Yeah, again, like, I have no idea what, like, tech methodology they use, but, like, it's kind of interesting. I don't know, like, how much they're doing or, like, what exactly they're doing there, but I don't know, it might like stress me out to look at the microbiome of my kid, like, because it's just like, you know, what are you going to do differently if I'm breastfeeding? Like, there's really not much. I don't know when they advise you to test either. But that they're kind of in the developmental stage. And like some of them are like, oh, look at your microbiome after you give your kid antibiotics. And like, well, that would make me feel crappy, you know, like, because again, like, there's a time and place for antibiotics. And sometimes you just have to do it if your kid has an infection.
Yeah.
You don't want to be like freaking out about the microbial changes and running out to do a stool test right away. Like, I don't know.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing is like, I think that kind of stuff could trigger a lot of health anxiety for people who maybe have like, because if you think about it, the parents who are inclined to order a stool test on their baby would probably be people who have had gut problems or maybe like autoimmune disease. Right. So they already probably have a lot of health anxiety to begin with, and then they're going to start translating that over to their kiddo. Right. And I don't know, like part of me sees the merit of a test like that, and then a bigger piece of me thinks it's really dangerous to put that in the hands of people who are already really anxious about health and like, you know, measuring everything. And you're right, like what would you do differently? Like you're already breastfeeding and you're going to feed her fruits and vegetables and healthy stuff once she does eat solid food. So I don't really know if it's all that actionable, truthfully.
Yeah, I think, again, like maybe if your kid had like a bunch of gut issues popping up or something and you're just like, but again, I just like don't know how much you can really manipulate to with, I don't know. It just seems a little excessive to me. Like you just want to keep doing the things that you know that kind of promote gut health when you can and not freak out when you take antibiotics or that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think you're right. It probably does trigger kind of some health anxiety stuff to pop up.
Yeah. I guess it goes back to like, just because we can test doesn't mean that we should test. Right.
Ooh, yeah. Like,
and I feel like that was a lot of testing. Like just because you can get a SIBO test doesn't mean that you should.
Right.
Like, is it
same thing going with like the Dutch? I know you think that way about the Dutch and the GI map. And
yeah, I feel that way about functional medicine. Like I've noticed for a long time that there are functional doctors and like naturopaths who are really into the testing, and they do like, you know, $4,000 or $5,000 of testing on every single patient, for example. And it's like, okay, just because you can order that amount of stuff on people, like, do you really need it? Like, right. I don't know if every single person needs a Dutch test and every single person needs a GI map and every single person needs a SIBO test and every single person needs an adrenal test. Like, there are some things like iron and a CBC and thyroid panel and like a liver panel. Like, I could see those being part of like a yearly once over for every single human being, but I don't know if everybody needs an OAT.
Yeah, well, and again, I think it also, when we take those clients on, it's like, okay, they've run a million tests and haven't really gotten better based on the actions of those tests because they're under eating. Like, it's something so simple that you had to look at like more qualitative data to see. Or again, they're have runaway stress or something that they need to tackle. So, you know, I think the most frustrating thing to me is that someone will run all those tests and they'll miss like the super obvious thing that they could have seen if they just looked at like more qualitative data, like recall, really listened to the client or patient. They're instead running all these tests and trying to find again, like all this, you know, insane, running all these markers when in reality it might be more simple. Like the answer is more simple. The solution might be hard for the person to implement. It's not to say like if you have if you live a stressful life, like you might need to change your job or something, which is a really hard thing to do. But like I think there's a lot of times missing really key elements that are obvious, but you have to look beyond the tests.
I would add too, I see pretty frequently people get the fancy tests or the sexy tests, but they don't get the basic tests. I just had one of these this past week. This woman that I'm working with, she went to the functional medicine like center or whatever at Cleveland Clinic. Mm-hmm. Like, okay, it's like Cleveland Clinic. That's the best of the best, right? And they have a center for like functional medicine excellence or whatever. And she had a whole buttload of tests run at the Cleveland Clinic. You know what ended up coming back really, really telling on her when I ran some initial tests recently? Hmm. Her iron panel, but not even for the reason you think. I think she has hemochromatosis. And a lot of her symptoms are lining up. Like, her liver enzymes have been elevated for a while, and her doctors are like, oh man, you're going to have cirrhosis. This is really bad. And they're freaking her out. And she has like a lot of joint pain, a lot of body pain, like brain fog, fatigue. She just feels like crap. She's gained a bunch of weight, and it comes back with an iron panel and ferritin that are really elevated and looks like hemochromatosis. And I looked back because I was like, huh, okay. And I looked back at her records that she had sent in to me. Nobody has run ferritin or an iron panel on this woman in the year's worth of data that she has collected. And it's like, guys, it's a $5 or $10 test. Why the hell are you not running this? You're jumping to the fancy schmancy test. And they're like, they're testing her for EBV and like mold markers, and they're doing SIBO, and they're doing all this other testing. Meanwhile, if you look up the symptoms of hematomicrosis, it's like, oh, like liver damage, aches and pains, and like widespread bodily inflammation and like fatigue and cognitive stuff. Like, most of her symptoms match up with this. So they're running the gene now for hematomicrosis. She has iron overload at the bare minimum, but they're running the genetic marker right now for hematomicrosis. And it's like, well, wouldn't this be really good to know? Cleveland Clinic? Like, not to directly throw shade at any one body of people, but like, come on.
Right. It's frustrating. Again, like, I think that there's so many instances like that. And not even, again, like, with just lab work, like you're describing, like, and just super obvious things. Like, I cannot tell you the degree of undereating that I see. It's almost every person. It's not every person, but it's almost every person that I work with where it's like, whoa, this is a problem. That, and they saw multiple providers. But I think the fancy test is an interesting dilemma too, because I think you're right. Like, do you really need the fancy test? Probably not. And again, like, I even think, I know we've talked a little bit about the Dutch test where it's like, well, the person says they're stressed, like, and they're exhibiting stress. Like, do we need to do like a, do we need to look and know exactly what's going on with their cortisol? Like, and is it that simple? Like, again, I know you were talking about like the stress profile is not just boiled down to cortisol. And then,
well, it even,
yeah, again, I just,
when my gut,
go ahead.
Oh, sorry. When my gut was really bad and I knew damn well I was stressed, like I had just come out of chiropractic school, grad school, and I was taking national board exams. I was sitting for my licensure. I was starting a practice. I had moved. Like, I knew without a shadow of a doubt in my mind that I was burnt out and I was stressed. And then I did an adrenal test to kind of like prove it to myself, and it came back perfectly normal. And that gave me the excuse to ignore my stress for about a decade. Like, I wish I had never run that stupid test, because I used it as an excuse of like, oh, well, you know, I might be feeling a bit stressed, but my adrenals are fine. Therefore, I don't need ashwagandha, or, you know, insert name of favorite adaptogen here. But looking back, I guarantee you I would have benefited highly from Nervines and adaptogens at that time in my life.
So, right. Totally. Well, and I think, too, I know you've been doing all your experiments. You want to tell us about those?
I do. But I will say, we didn't plan this episode well. I mean, we did, but we didn't. Because you got to talk about your freaking baby, your human baby with all the hair in the world. And that was such a good update. And now mine feel, honestly, kind of lame by comparison. But
no.
I'm going to try. And I'm still going to try to be a crowd pleaser here. But so I've been sulking because we haven't been recording episodes for a couple months and I've missed it. I mean, we keep in touch a ton, like pretty much every day. Armand told you, what, 2 days ago that you talk to me more than you talk to him, which I'm in favor of. Like, I'm cool with it. Right. So it's not that we haven't talked, but we haven't like recorded conversations and thought about this stuff. So yeah, I've been sulking a little bit. Like I said, most recently my family had COVID. Luckily it wasn't crazy bad for us. Like it still kind of sucked and nobody likes to be sick, but my daughter brought it home from school. She got sick first. She really took one for the team because then that gave us enough of a head start that we were like, okay, shit's getting real, man. So I had my husband and I taking literally every supplement on planet Earth. We were taking like 18 capsules of stuff per meal 3 times a day and tinctures and teas. I was just like, nope, we're throwing everything we've got at this. And we had about a 2-day head start. So we started everything. I think my daughter started to exhibit symptoms Saturday night. And that's when I was like, okay, we should probably start taking some stuff and just in case. And then I developed symptoms Monday afternoon. So we had a 2-day head start on me with like, you know, echinacea and angiographis and vitamin C and all of that kind of stuff. And I really think it's because I took everything but the kitchen sink. Like I got moderately sick, and then my husband did not get sick at all, which is miraculous and amazing.
Oh my gosh.
And now I'm like 99.5% of the way there, and I'm just getting rid of this last little like residual tickly cough kind of thing. But that was my most recent. I'm going to do mine working backwards in time. I don't know why, but it feels like the thing to do now. Okay. So that was most recent. That was last week. Then, and now people can figure out when we're recording this because people saw my story saying I had COVID. Most recently, I've been working a lot on the practitioner course I'm developing. I guess I never got a chance to announce it here, but on my birthday in July, I did a K-pop dance reel that was frankly epic. And in that reel, I announced, oh, BTW, I'm working on a practitioner training course. And I'm really excited about that. It's going to be really, really good if I do say so myself. And, you know, I don't want to say it's me being charitable because it's not, but like, I'm going to pack it full of really good stuff and make it pretty reasonably priced because we need more practitioners who know what they're doing with SIBO. Like it right. cannot just be you and me for the rest of our careers, Amy. We are going to be inundated with people. It's just not practical. And like, we need more people on the ground, so to speak, who are able to help patients with IBS and SIBO. And right now there's like nothing really kind of filling that void in a way that I think needs to be done. So I'm working on that. It's going to be awesome. It's very time consuming, but I'm really excited about it. Right now, I'm going to be opening up rolling enrollment in the fall. And then I'm aiming to have everything ready to go and like the content ready for people who register in early December. So if you're a practitioner or a nutritionist, keep your eyes peeled. It won't be open to the general public because honestly, it's going to be probably too thick and sciencey for the general right. public to really benefit much from. And like, there's going to be like an entire giant lecture, for example, about breath testing and like the pros and cons, what the research says, sensitivity and specificity. Like if you are going to order it, here are the contraindications, here's the indications. Like it's going to be much more like focused on if you were to order this on a patient, how would you interpret the information and how would you make the best of the information? So not super applicable for lay people, but for practitioners, I think it's going to be a game changer if I do say so myself. I'm also waiting for my equivalent of my Hogwarts letter because my K-pop dance was so good that I'm just waiting for JYP to reach out to me and say, yo man, we have to have you. Like we're making a new K-pop girl group and we absolutely need you to be like the center of that group. Please fly to Korea. So just so you know, I might be flying to Korea and never coming back because I'm going to be a K-pop star. So that's another huge update for me. I went to Buffalo and saw family. This was another biggie. This is going to be a little risky because I truthfully don't know if any of my husband's family listens to my podcast. I don't think they do. I don't even think my own mom listens to my podcast. I don't, like, very occasionally she does. Hi, Mom. But I don't think any of my husband's family listens to the podcast, so I feel okay saying this. Oh, my God, man. I was bugging out the entire time, hanging out with normal people. Like, I forget that I'm in a bubble until I leave my bubble, and then I realize,
oh my gosh,
how different I am. And I'm not even super extreme. Like, we've talked about this before. Like, there are, you know, I've met naturopaths who are like, I will not eat at a restaurant unless it's 100% certified organic. And then you take them to the freaking organic restaurant, the only one in town, and they grill the waiter or waitress with, like, is this free range? Or is this grass-fed 100%? Or is it grain-finished? And it's like, you are insufferable. Stop. Just eat your food. And, like, is this wild-caught cauliflower? Like, oh, my God, I can't handle you. And, you know, and there are people who, like, are hardcore anti-sugar. Like, if you even suggest that you might have sugar in your household, they look at you like you murdered a kitten and then barbecued it. So I'm not even extreme in any health arena. Like, I'm very genuinely moderate about nutrition and health. And, like, my overarching philosophy is do the right thing and try to be healthy 90% of the time. Like, move your body, try to get enough sleep, eat fruits and vegetables, try to get some sun, like, you know, manage your schedule such that it's not totally draining your life force out of you. Like, do all of those things 90% of the time. And that way, if you do have a part of your life where, like, you're staying up late or you're really, really stressed or you're eating absolute garbage, you don't have to worry about it too much because you already laid that foundation. That being said, so that's, like, my philosophy on health. My husband's side of the family, by and large, has very different views, and they eat what I can only describe as garbage, literally 99% of the time. And it was truly odd. We were camping with some family and their kids, and just the sheer amount of junk food was truly horrific to me. Like, the kids, you know, the kids were just told to graze for lunch, which they told me that ahead of time. And I was like, oh, okay. Like, grazing, we would have done that. Like, if we were on a beach trip or a camping trip, my mom might have said, like, oh, we're just going to graze for lunch. But for my family, and to be clear, like, my mom was very, very heavy all of growing up, and we definitely ate a lot of bear claws and Pop-Tarts and junky food. But, like, even so, my definition of grazing would have been like, oh, we'll bring some hummus and crackers and baby carrots and cucumbers and strawberries and maybe, like, a can of Pringles, watermelon, maybe some, like, sandwiches, like turkey sandwiches or something that you cut in half and you could have, like, half a sandwich if you want. Like, that's my definition of grazing for, like, a lunch thing. But it was literally multiple varieties of cookies, Dunkaroos, which I forgot existed. I forgot they made.
I thought those were out of style too.
Yeah, I didn't even know they were still around, but they are. Multiple types of cookies, Dunkaroos, little snack size baggies of chips, and Rice Krispie treats, you know, the ones that have, like, the marshmallow fluff and the M&Ms and stuff embedded in them. And that was lunch for this family, literally all of the days we were there. And what made it difficult and frustrating was, like, they definitely know that we're more health conscious. And what made it hard is that then our daughter wanted to eat the way that that family was eating. And, you know, the first day or two, I tiptoed around it and kind of, like, brought her over to the side and whispered in her ear, like, hey, no, we need to eat some healthy things. That's all junk food. Like, we need to eat healthy things first and then you can have treats, kind of a thing.
Right.
And the last 2 days we were there, I like, snapped mentally and I couldn't have it handle it anymore. It was also, like, hot and humid and there was mosquitoes. But the last 2 days I was there, I just snapped and I was like, whatever, I'm just going to say it out loud and I'm not even going to whisper it. And I was just telling my daughter, like, no, we're not eating junk for lunch. You have to eat real food too. And I, you know, it is what it is. Like, I'm going to call a spade a spade. And I tried to like spare their feelings the first couple days, but then after another couple days, part of me was like, no, they need to know. Do they not know? Do they not know?
Right.
Like, if they don't know, I need to let them know on some level. So I don't know. I wasn't intentionally being antagonistic, but I like gave up the effort to like spare their feelings after the first 2 days.
I'm like basically. Seeing like, I feel like I'm picturing just you on this camping trip, like each day going by, like a nervous tick, like in your eye, getting a little basically. Bit more intense, like each day, basically. Just trying to like keep it together.
Yeah, it. And I'm a lover, not a fighter. Like I really, right. I don't know because I'm bound to be biased, but I like to think I'm a nice person. And I like to think I'm not confrontational and I'm really not that judgmental. But again, like I swear to God, like if you hung out with me any day of the week, if you busted out some potato chips or some chocolate or a cookie, I am not going to judge you at all.
Right,
I might
right.
even ask you for some of your potato chips. But like nothing but junk.
Right. Right.
All day for like 4 days in a row. Like that I am judging.
Right.
Like
right.
there's a line, right? Like I always really liked the Michael Pollan line of treat treats as treats.
Right.
Like that's the most perfect way you could put it. Treat treats as treats. If you have treats every meal of every day in unlimited, unrestricted access, by the way, too, like the kids could just wander up and open a drawer and get a Dunkaroo any moment of any day they were there.
Right.
Unrestricted, totally unchecked. And it's like, that's a really big problem, in my opinion. If you have, like, if you have dessert after you have a healthy meal, I think that's fine. Or if right. you, like, go to a birthday party and you have the birthday cake, like, that's fine. I'm not going to judge that. But it's like this never-ending smorgasbord of utter crap that I just could not wrap my head around. I'm still recovering. And this trip was, like, a month and a half ago.
Right.
But, yeah, it was weird being around normies. And
I don't know if that's necessarily like, normal though either. Like I don't know.
I feel like it might be. I feel like it might be.
Like
dude.
Every single like, meal though.
We're weird.
I don't know.
Well, they would try so like breakfast with this family, they had muffins, but they were like the really sugary muffins
right.
from the grocery store that has like a million chocolate chips in them.
Right.
Looked amazing for the record. But and then sometimes the parents would make like an egg or a sausage, like McMuffin kind of a thing. So that was okay. At least there's protein. Lunch, everybody ate the absolute shit. Meanwhile, I'm sitting there with hummus and baby carrots, right. like trying to get my daughter to eat them with me.
Right.
And then dinner was oftentimes some like meat done on the grill. And I don't really remember what they brought. We went to the grocery store a lot when we were there. So we would get, like, we got zucchini, we got corn, and we, like, threw the corn into the fire kind of a thing. One time I got, like, 3 cloves of garlic, and I peeled all of them and wrapped them in foil with some olive oil, and I just threw it in the fire. And my husband and I, not single-handed, double-handedly demolished 3 whole cloves of garlic in one sitting, and it was amazing. So like we tried to have like some sort of veggie with each of the meals.
Right.
And then we'd have like fruit for dessert kind of a thing. I don't really remember what they would do with their meat. I think like pasta salad and like camping kind of,
right.
kind of fare, but yeah, I don't know. It was, and then like ice cream every single night. I'm like, it's like, I'm not going to judge if you want to get ice cream every now and then, but every night,
right.
Like,
right.
I don't know. So yeah, that was a bit much. I just pray that they're not listening to this episode right now because they're never going to talk to me again.
I think you're probably safe.
I feel like we're safe. Like, luckily, we have a pretty niche-y
right,
podcast.
Right.
So for people who don't have IBS or SIBO, they're very disinterested in our topic, right, probably. Right. But yeah, but the trip was lovely otherwise. And got to, you know, see a bunch of waterfalls because we were down in Ithaca where I grew up and got to see some people. And it was really nice. And then the poop experiments. I think I was a researcher in a previous life, but maybe like a little bit of a zany one. Yeah. I don't know if I would have gotten like funding from big companies like NIH. I think I probably would have gotten like private donor kind of funds. But so I've had my microbiome stool experiment running now for a few months. The initial batch of information I got on glucomannan was very compelling and interesting. And I've got a YouTube video up on my channel if you want to check that out. Some of it was surprising. And I noticed, so the study design I've been doing is 2-week washout periods, like a baseline,
right,
followed by 2 weeks of a prebiotic. So the first one was glucomannan, and then 2 weeks of a washout period, 2 weeks of a new prebiotic, and I keep cycling them. And what I've been looking for, my hypothesis going into this, was that after 2 weeks on a prebiotic, I would see a change. Like, let's say a bacteria went up after, you know, from baseline, after I took the prebiotic for 2 weeks, I expected that some bacteria would go up. And then after I discontinued the experiment, then they would come back down in the washout period. Mm-hmm. Right. So like when I'm feeding them, they go up, and when I'm not feeding them, they come back down. And that pattern to me was like confirmation of, yeah, that thing that I observed is what I really observed. Similarly, if something is like suppressing or competing with a bad guy, I might see between the baseline and the intervention phase of the study, I would see the thing go down. But then once I discontinued that intervention, I would expect to see it go back up to baseline. So right. I when I did my first video, I talked about it in that way. But what was interesting was my bifidobacteria didn't budge at all during that intervention phase of the study with glucomannan, but then they shot up out of nowhere 2 weeks later, 2 full weeks after I discontinued the prebiotic. And I was like, what the heck is that? And I remember the video I was talking about, I was like, I had like 1 or 2 glasses of red wine like 6 days prior. Maybe that was it. Or, you know, dietary fluctuations. I was like, I really don't know what to make of this. And I just kind of wrote it off as a fluke. Well, I have the PHGG data back in now, and I'm hoping to record that video today, actually, so I can get it up this week. But I got the PHGG data, and the same damn thing happened. My bifido didn't budge for the 2 weeks on PHGG. And then 2 weeks later, they shot up like a rocket, 2 full weeks after I discontinued the PHGG. And I'm like scratching my head. And I tried to book an appointment with Jason Haverlack, the probiotic advisor guy, because I think that he is really knowledgeable, but I think that his understanding of the microbiome from both a research and a clinical perspective is probably the best we have in the world right now, from what I can tell.
Right.
And I'm genuinely perplexed by this thing with the bifidobacteria doing that.
Right.
And so I tried to reach out and make an appointment with him, but the earliest he had available was like April 2023. And we're recording this in mid-September 2022. So it would have been minimum 6 to 8 months for me to get in with him. And I was like, I'm just not that patient.
Right, no, thank you.
I can't wait that long. So I'm going to post the PHGG video, but I am going to mention in that video, I've decided to redesign the experiment. So I kind of scrapped the original experiment and I haven't been collecting for a little while. And with COVID, I was taking a probiotic and I was eating weird and I was taking a million things.
Right.
And I was taking like turmeric and sulforaphane and things that could alter my microbiome. So right now I'm going to give myself like a month to just kind of come back to whatever my baseline is after having had COVID. So right now I'm in a holding pattern just because I surely altered my microbiome during COVID. But I think what I'm going to do now, and this is, it makes me so sad and frustrated because this is the opposite of instant gratification, and it's going to require me to be much more patient. And I don't want to be patient, but it is what it is. So now what I've decided to do is instead of 2 weeks in the intervention phase, I'm going to do a full month. And instead of only sampling at the very end of the experimental phase, I'm going to sample throughout the entire month. And what I'm expecting to find with hypothesis number two here, what I would expect to find is that as I take, say, like PHGG, as I take a prebiotic, I would probably expect incremental changes. Like, okay, after 1 week, it changes this percent. After another week, it's this percent. After a third week, it's this percent. After a fourth week, it's this percent. So I'm expecting to see linear incremental changes. And then likewise, I'm going to give myself a full month off of the prebiotic. And similarly, I would expect those numbers probably to fall maybe a little bit quicker. But I would expect it to fall and then remain pretty stable after I discontinue the prebiotic. Like I said, though, it's basically doubling the length of each experimental period.
Right.
So that means I was kind of hoping to get a groove where I could post one video in the series every month. That goes out the window
right
now. So that's a no-go, but that's what you do in science. You have a hypothesis, you go to prove or disprove the hypothesis. And if you run into a problem or if you can't prove the hypothesis, you have to scrap it and you have to start all over again. Right. So, I'm living the life of a true scientist right now. And then I have another poop experiment in the works right now. The video may or may not be out on YouTube by the time this episode posts. I'm not sure yet, but, basically we've talked a little bit before on this podcast that I am very skeptical and leery of the GI map. Honestly, like, I don't think the GI effects is much better. I don't really think, you know, Biome FX is much better. What's the one from Vibrant America, the Gut Zoomer? Like, I don't think any of these are all that good, to be truthful. But I'm especially irked with the GI map on a regular basis because everybody acts like it's God's greatest gift to humankind. Like, it's, you know, the angels bestowed the GI map upon us and they smiled. And I just don't think that that's true. And like my whole profession is like blinded by the GI map and they think it's the best thing ever. So I've been really skeptical and leery of the GI map for some time. And I finally just kind of had a screw it moment. And I said, you know, I'm going to put my money where my mouth is. Because I think I've expressed to you that I've had many occasions where calprotectin comes back elevated and I go, whoa, we need to make sure this is the case because if your calprotectin is really this elevated, we need to send you to a GI doctor for a scope.
Right.
Like you might have Crohn's or colitis. And every single time I've done that based on a high calprotectin with the GI map, every single time I've had the person go to LabCorp request to redo it, it has come back normal.
Right.
Similarly, the pancreatic elastase, I've had numbers come back really low. Like I had one lady, it came back like 46,
right,
which is like, ooh, you should be dead. Like that's real low.
Right.
So it came back low on the GI map. And I've had many instances where similarly, I'm like, ooh, we need to do our due diligence and make sure we're treating this appropriately. Let's double check it with LabCorp or Quest. If it really is this low, you actually might benefit from Creon or like prescription enzymes or at the bare minimum, digestive enzymes,
right,
like OTC. And every single time I've done that, it's come back completely different.
Right.
Like normal or close to normal.
Right.
So, but the problem is that, you know, the turnaround time for the GI map is like 10 to 14 days. So by the time you mail the sample, it gets to the lab, they report the results, and then I get the results in my portal. And then even if I write the LabCorp order for you that same day, and even if you go to LabCorp and collect the stool sample that same day, minimum week and a half, if not 2 weeks has passed by.
Right.
So the kind of burning question in my brain this whole time has been, okay, am I seeing this pattern because the numbers are genuinely different 2 weeks later when the person goes into LabCorp?
Right.
Or is the GI map wrong? One or the other. And I don't want to give away all of the video because I don't know if it's going to be published quite yet by the time we post this episode, but it's very damning.
Right, right.
Shall we
right.
say. It's very damning. The GI map is completely out in left field. I have a couple. I have one data point that's really quite telling. I just got another pair. So basically what I had, what happened is I had a couple of patients and students where I said, hey, if you collect your poop, I'll pay for these tests for you. I need guinea pigs. So what we did was we did a calprotectin and a pancreatic elastase from LabCorp and calprotectin and pancreatic elastase from Quest. And not one, but two GI maps, all from the same person, the same day, the same stool sample.
Yeah.
And I instructed people to mix up the poop so that it's nice and homogenous, or as homogenous as possible. And then you send them off to the respective labs, but it's all from the same exact day.
Right.
And the same exact poop. And it does not stack up, people. It does not stack up. There was something very surprising in the data that I still need to figure out, like, what on earth happened with that, to be honest. But I think it's very damning for the GI map. And one thing I'll share, too, beyond the pancreatic elastase and calprotectin, on both of these, I don't know if I told you, I think I did, on both of these two data sets that I have back so far, on one of the tests, they had a pathogen on the first page of the report come back positive. And on the other page, it was below detectable limit.
Right.
One person on one test supposedly had Giardia. On the other GI map test from the same exact person, same exact day, no Giardia. The other one was some sort of funky E. coli infection, I think. And on the other GI map from the same person, same day, same turd, none. And it's like, okay, that's the one I've been using it for. Like, I've been thinking at least the boogeymen on the first page and like the parasite part of the panel, at least those are usable, right? Don't know. And same thing happened with both of those people, that on one test, it showed a low but detectable level of H. pylori. The other one, H. pylori was below detectable limit for both of them. I'm like,
right.
Okay. So like, can we really use this for H. pylori? I don't think so. Yeah. I'm waiting on the third person to get their data sent in and collected, but I'm hoping to have that back in the next couple weeks so I can post the video sometime in October, because so far it has been juicy. Absolutely juicy.
That's, again, like, it's so interesting just because you're right. Like, everyone's using the GI map. When people come to me, they're going, hey, are we going to run a GI map? Like, even people now, the customers or clients that we work with, I should say, are the ones that are, like, asking for it.
Yeah.
And I honestly think the marketing has gone so deep as to where, like, the clients think that that's the best test. And so, like, you try to introduce another test.
Have you had your GI mapped? Like, it's a very, it's clever wording, it's clever naming, and they have amazing marketing. Right. And they came out of nowhere. Like, one day, nobody had heard of the GI map, and they were non-existent. And then the next day, overnight sensation. And I find that very fishy. The Dutch test did the same exact thing. One day the Dutch was non-existent. The next day was an overnight sensation and everybody was running it. And it was really bizarre. It's I think part of this too is like the reality is that a lot of the people that you might think of working with or the people that you follow on Instagram or podcasts, like they're small business owners. And we need to figure out ways to convince people to come pay us money, right?
Right.
And, like, that's okay. Like, any business has to do that. But I've noticed in the functional medicine space, one of the carrots that they dangle to get you to pay the big bucks to come in and see them is the testing.
Right.
And they'll say things like, test, don't guess, which I hate now. I hate that so much. And they'll say, like, and they'll post, you know, I've seen people, like somebody that both of us follow, I think, will post like snippets from a GI map on like Instagram reels. They'll have it in like the background on a green screen and they'll talk about like, oh, we found this boogeyman on the GI map. And oh my God, this is stupendous and amazing. And oh my God. And they hype it up. They hype it up so much of like, here's a case. And they could be real case studies, but like, here's this person who had X symptom. We ran a GI map. We got them answers.
Right.
And then they felt amazing. And that is so highly appealing and sexy to hear that, especially the part of like, we got them answers and then they felt better. People who have been suffering for a long time are like, oh, that's what I want. I just want answers and then I want to feel better. Oh my God.
Right.
But it's like, they very intentionally dangle the carrot of the fancy schmancy testing and answers. And I think that's why we see, because I have the same thing, like people come to me asking for a GIMAP test specifically by name. And I'm like, this, it's almost up there with like, you know how you watch TV and you see, ask your doctor if your Belinda is right for you. Side effects of your Belinda could include bloody diarrhea, blah, 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 blah. And it's like, how, like, I don't know if you do this. We are one of two countries on the planet, if I remember correctly, that allows pharmaceutical companies to make commercials and put them on TV and advertise and advertise to lay people. That's literally illegal in every other country other than like us and I think New Zealand or Australia.
Well, and I think when I've looked at it, the data on that too, I think it's over, it's either 50% or a little over 50% of prescriptions are actually written at the request of the patient. So,
it's
you know, not only are we advertising for drugs, but most of the time, the patient's asking the doctor for the script for the drug.
It's a dream come true for pharmaceutical companies. Like, it's the best thing in the world for them. But yeah, it's like, I almost feel like patients specifically asking for the GI map by name almost feels akin to somebody asking for a prescription from their doctor. Like, I'm sorry, shouldn't the doctor make the decision of what test is appropriate for you? Or shouldn't the doctor make the decision of what pharmaceutical is appropriate for you? Like, that's that's a little, can I be young? Is it choogy?
Oh my gosh.
I feel like it might be choogy. I don't know if I'm using that word right, but I think it might be choogy. I'm going to go with it, man. Like, I'm, you know?
Yep.
And see, I have to be in touch with the youth of today because, again, I'm going to be a K-pop idol very soon.
Oh my gosh.
And, you know, they're going to be like interviewing me and stuff in Korean, obviously. So I have to get on that. But I need to be like hip with the kids and know the lingo that they're saying. So I just use Chugi. Go me.
Well, again, like I understand why someone might, again, ask for it. It's just, again, it's frustrating how much that has been so ingrained in the functional medicine space, like what you're saying. You know, it's just so pervasive.
Yeah.
And again, it doesn't necessarily, it's not as deserving as being so pervasive. Because again, like you were saying, we've discussed too, I've had cases where calprotectin's been wildly off. Like we go back and forth of, oh, you know, I saw this and that, and it just doesn't add up.
Yeah.
And I wonder too if it's almost like they're just trying to do too much in one panel, like Jack off of one sample.
Yeah.
If that affects the accuracy of the data, that's kind of my hypothesis. Like when you're looking at digestive markers and immune markers and also the bacteria, and again, you're looking at all this data and you're trying to make your test as comprehensive as possible. I'm just wondering if you might lose some of the accuracy when you do that. I don't know. Again, I'm not behind the scenes there, but that's kind of my hypothesis.
And I will say too, like, I think you're right. I think it's jack of all trades, master of none. I think too, you know, I do want to say like, I completely, totally see the appeal for a test like that. And that's why I have used the GI map on and off for a few years. And I have used things like the Genova GI effects. Like it's very appealing from a clinical standpoint and from a patient standpoint to do a single sample, a single collection. Generally by combining it like that, it ends up being cheaper, believe it or not. Like if you did a stool PCR bacteria test, which basically ends up being the first page of the GI map. If you did that exact test from LabCorp, because they do offer one like that, it's like $500. And the GI map is like 300 something. And you get all the digestive markers. Right. And I know this because, again, I've been doing this experiment. Calprotectin, I think, is like $269. And these are all from like cash co-ops. So the price is all negotiated. I think pancreatic elastase was like $169. So even if you add up the very first page of the GI map and calprotectin and pancreatic elastase, you're topping out $800-$900 already, and you didn't get right. any of the other parts of it yet, versus the GI map that's right. 300 something. So it's an expensive test, but it's actually a very cheap test when you think about it. But I do think they're trying to do so much that they're not really particularly good right. at any of the things. And yeah, I wonder about that with other like functional right. labs sometimes. And it's unfortunate because, again, I totally 100% see the appeal. I want these to be good. I want right. to root for the labs and have the fancy answers. But, and like the lab testing was part of what kind of swooned me right. into functional medicine years ago. But the longer I've been in this and the more test results I've seen and the more like complicated cases, you know, where like people did protocols based on these flawed tests and then they didn't get better. Like I'm seeing that so right. much clinically that like at some point you have to stop right. and question it. Speaking of which, can I segue into another yeah. thing I want to share in our updates? Everyone needs to have a bullshit detector, in the words of The Good Place. For those of you who need a translation, it's bullshit detector. But you all need to have a bullshit detector going 24/7 because the world is riddled with it. And I think I'm pretty sure I ranted to you on Marco Polo like a madwoman about this recently. So I'm working on this big presentation that I'm doing for an association. And it's basically just like 4-hour crash course mm-hmm. on SIBO. And one of the things I'm talking about is SIBO associated conditions. So like what other diagnoses might tip you off that your patient could have SIBO and you might want to evaluate right. them for that. Right. So like if somebody walks in your door with cancer, maybe you don't think SIBO right away. But if somebody walks in with irritable bowel syndrome or rosacea, you maybe should think of SIBO right away, right? So I have a section in this course where I'm talking about some of the conditions that are associated with SIBO in the research. And one of them I'm talking about is IBD, so Crohn's and colitis. Well, I had like one article that I had found a while back that I did a YouTube video about, and I used some data from that. But then I found another newer systematic review and meta-analysis. And it was 2021, and it was the incidence of methane SIBO in IBD. And I was like, ooh, this is juicy. Because the other one was just like SIBO overall. They didn't specify methane. And it's a brand new article. So I was like, ooh, saucy. So I'm reading it. And for those of you who aren't in the know, ulcerative colitis is typically a very diarrhea-dominant condition, like bloody, mucousy diarrhea. It's not fun stuff. Crohn's can have constipation or diarrhea, but I have seen, and I believe like textbooks would back me up, that I think diarrhea or loose stools is more common with Crohn's as well. It's typically not bloody. It could be mucousy, though. But both of these conditions are very diarrhea-dominant, and we know methane typically causes constipation, right? So I was going into reading this article, kind of hypothesizing right out the bat, and they said that the incidence of methane SIBO was way higher in ulcerative colitis than it was in Crohn's. And I was like, what? How does that make sense? And I'm reading this, and just automatically, like, the bullshit detector is going off in my brain. Like, woo, 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 you've got to check that. So, you know, so what did I do? I got the PDF of the article. I think it was, like, free on PubMed Central. So I go to the PDF, and I start reading, and I start skimming it for their references. And they had a chart. Oftentimes, there will be a chart where it's, like, you know, the study, the authors, the number of participants, the criteria, what the results were. And it's all in like graphical form. So I scroll down and I see this graph with all the citations. And I see that there's only two that included ulcerative colitis specifically. A bunch of the articles just said like incidence of methane SIBO and IBD. They didn't break it up between the two. And then a couple of articles looked at Crohn's, but they didn't look at colitis. And then only two papers looked at colitis. So I was like, okay, well, first of all, that's a really small sample set, but okay. And I look at one, and one of them, one article, like the point of the article was not even remotely related to assessing methane SIBO in UC. Like it was an incidental finding, which means that they found it kind of coincidentally and they noted it in their paper. So it was an incidental finding. It was kind of like thrown in there like, oh, BT-dub, like here's what we found with UC. Neato, eh? And then they continued on with the rest of the paper. So I was like, okay, that's low quality. Right. And it was a very small sample size, like 20 people. So I was like, first of all, like that's not great quality. Right. So that one I'm kind of like, off the table. I kid you not. The second one that they used in this systematic review and meta-analysis, which should be top of the top, like cream of the crop, the best quality research we have, and it should be like peer-reviewed and checked by people and verified, and it should be high quality. This freaking systematic review and meta-analysis uses this other paper from 1987. First of all, it's almost as old as me. And number two, they did not say SIBO or even overgrowth anywhere in the entire paper. They didn't even talk about SIBO. You know what they did? They did a single breath sample, and it was a binary yes, no. Do you produce methane or do you not produce methane? You were considered a methane producer, quote unquote, if you made even one part per million of methane in your breath sample. And then they just tallied it up like, oh, this many of the controls, this many people with IBS, this many people with Crohn's, this many people with colitis. And it was a binary, do you make methane or do you not, in a single breath sample. For those of you who know SIBO, you know that you cannot diagnose SIBO with a single breath sample. That's not how it works.
Right.
So they were looking at like baseline methane, not SIBO methane.
Right.
And again, and the article's older than dirt. Like it's like 35 years old. Like, I'm sorry. I'm not old. Obviously I'm young and I'm going to be a K-pop artist.
Right.
But as far as like academic research goes, that's pretty freaking old. And again, they did not assess for SIBO. They did not claim to assess for SIBO. They didn't even say the word SIBO in the entire paper. They were just looking to see who had the presence of methane and who did not. And that study said, oh yeah, like, I forget what the numbers were, but like, oh, like 30% of UC patients had some methane in their breath sample versus only like 7% of people with Crohn's. And therefore, and then the meta-analysis people took that, they were like, ah, so that means methane SIBO for all the UC people and no methane SIBO for the Crohn's people. Like, they interpreted it totally wrong. And I don't for the life of me understand how. Like, it was very clear in that old-ass paper what they were looking at and what they were not looking at. I do not understand how they interpreted this incorrectly. But anyway, my point is, I could see a scenario where a layperson or a healthcare professional would see this meta-analysis, read the abstract, read the conclusion, and they would go, oh, and now I know that methane SIBO is very common in ulcerative colitis. And they might go and test all of their UC patients for methane SIBO. But you've got to have your wits about you, and you've got to have your bullshit detector running at all times, because even what should be good quality research is going to lead you astray and just be wrong a fair amount of the time. This is one of the most heartbreaking things about my adult life, is that I went into grad school thinking that research was like infallible, rock solid. You can always believe the research because it's peer reviewed. So obviously it's always great. And the slow realization that there's a lot of deeply flawed research out there has just been really heartbreaking for me, because I want to believe it, but I can't. And so anyway, just keep your detector going.
Keep your peepers. Keep your peepers out.
Wits about you. And then I have one more to mention, and then we can maybe wrap up here.
Yeah, my boobs are getting a little squeamish.
Squeamish? I didn't know that was a thing.
Well, they're like,
see, people didn't release us. Yeah. All right, hold on. Okay, so I had been messaging with somebody on Instagram recently, back and forth a little bit. And again, I might have told you this. I'm not positive, though. Also, keep your wits about you when so-called experts say something that you find suspicious. I guess, like, this is part two of this rant. So somebody had messaged me on Instagram. We've gone back and forth before. But she said, I just heard the latest from Pimentel. He said lactobacillus is a disruptor of the small intestine and should be avoided. Nerding out on that. Get well soon. And she basically said, because I asked, could you send me a link to that? And she said that she couldn't find it. It was in the stories. She said, here's a quote from an article. One thing that we're seeing in another paper is that lactobacillus is a disruptor of the small bowel. I'm like, okay. Well, I went, and because I'm working on this practitioner course, I happened to reread the Pimentel's group, their 2021 Reimagined study, which is where they're looking at the microbiome in the small bowel. So I went and I was rereading their 2021 Reimagined paper, and I messaged her back and I was like, I don't know what the F he's talking about, because he's directly conflicting with his own research. So the paper said, in patients with high disruptor taxolotes, so like there were other groups of bacteria like Klebsiella that they labeled disruptors, because when they are present, they basically crowd out everything else and they take over the whole kit and caboodle. So it was like Klebsiella, E. coli, and one type of Clostridium. So that's what they mean by that. In patients with high disruptor taxoloads, after excluding lactobacillus, the presence of lactobacillus at greater than 5 × 10^4 copies per ml negatively correlated with bloating symptoms. Another part of the paper said, these two facts led us to believe lactobacillus likely has a more nuanced relationship with the host than other taxa we classified as disruptors. Thus, we removed lactobacillus from our list of disruptor taxa. Meanwhile, the man is going live and he's telling people that lactobacillus is a disruptor of the small intestine. And it's like,
oh my gosh.
Your own paper specifically said the opposite. I don't know what the hell you're talking about. And it's, you know, I've worried with him, and we've talked about this before, that maybe, he might be biased towards, the miracle cure for everybody on planet Earth is rifaximin. And everything else other than rifaximin, we should just ignore. So I'm not surprised to hear him like poo-pooing probiotics, for example, because like if it's not rifaximin, he's probably not going to recommend it.
Right.
But to hear him specifically say that it's dangerous and to be avoided and it's a disruptor taxa when their paper directly says that it's not just really made me mad. And similar, it reminded me of the recent thing that he said of like, don't take betaine HCl because it feeds methane because it contains hydrogen. Right. And I was like frothing at the mouth at that one, because I'm like, you know what else contains a lot of freaking hydrogen? Water. You got to tell me not to drink water, dude? Like, that's not how it works.
Right.
Shut up. So anyway, so similarly, hopefully Pimentel doesn't listen to this, or hopefully he does. I don't know. Hopefully he does. But yeah, just keep your wits about you, people, because even the experts might be full of baloney more than we want to acknowledge.
Right.
Yeah. Oh, man. Well, this was a happy episode, a happy way to end the episode. I feel like we need something. Tell everybody briefly how Chip is doing.
Oh, Chip. Mr. Chip, he's been very protective lately, which is new. Lots of barking, which isn't very new. Used to not bark much. He likes to check on Cece when she's crying. But he's also kind of a little sad because he doesn't get as much attention. So it's getting better. Again, like as she's getting older, we are kind of back in the routine of petting him in the mornings. Mm. But he still doesn't get nearly as much as he used to. So it's kind of it's an up and down journey for Chip.
Well, I'm glad he's a good big brother, though.
Yes. He really is.
Well, Mamacita, do you have any parting words for our dear people? Or shall you go get your, what did you describe them as? Twitchy boobs?
I think I said, what did I even, I don't even know. I don't even remember.
We'll have to go back.
No,
we'll go with twitchy.
Yeah, they're, it's a hard time having an oversupply. I know, like, it's kind of annoying. I think, you know, when my sister had an undersupply, so she was like, oh man, it's so nice that you have an oversupply. But then she's like, well, you also have to pump a ton more, and like, you're leaking everywhere, and it's like, oh man, like, it's just a lot. But yeah, I gotta just make sure I'm releasing them when they need to, or again, making sure she feeds on time, or else they get a little painful mm-hmm. boobs.
Yep. Well, and I think I can't think of a better way to end this episode than talking about your boobs. So thank you for that.
You're welcome.
We will be back next week, guys, with more nerdy academic kind of material. But this was just our... this one was for the real fans. This was for the people who just want to know how we're doing and what we're conjuring up and what mayhem we are up to in our lives. And then we're going to get into, you know, more like clinically actionable information so that we can help you feel better in the next episode. But it's good to be back. Season 2, here we come. We're doing it. We're already in season 2, hard to believe. And like I said, I hope that this audio quality is pleasing to the ear and soothing to you. It's like a massage for your brain right now. I hope that you're enjoying that. And we will see you next week, right back here on the IBS Freedom Podcast. Toodaloo.